This is episode 50 of the Wildlife Photography Podcast. In this episode, Q&A. Hi everybody, my name is Jerry, I'm from Wild Eye, and I finally found some time, cancel that, made some time to sit down and record episode 50. So, first of all, thank you so much for going on this ride with me. When I started this, and it's the same with the videos from a while ago, is I never thought I'd get to 50 so quick. It's the nice thing with the podcast for me is it's very easy. I mean, I can do it in the evenings when I get home. Mornings like today, it's Monday morning, working from home for a little bit to get some stuff done. Or in the car. I've done some pretty cool ones in the car. And it's a nice way for me to kind of share, because there's a lot of thoughts happening all the time. And when they pop up, share it on a podcast. And I think it's great. So the feedback has been phenomenal. So to you guys out there listening, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. So as you know, the episode 50 is going to be Q&A. So over the last couple of weeks, I've been asking you guys for some questions and I've printed them out. I've got a whole stack of papers in front of me on the desk here. So I'm going to take them in no particular order. I'll read you the question, where it was asked, by who, and I'll answer it to the best of my ability. It's always a nice thing to see where people are coming from, what kind of questions they have with regards to wildlife photography. And I'm going to try and keep the questions as, and this is difficult for me sometimes, focused as possible, because I can go down rabbit holes every once in a while, but I'm going to try and stick to the questions and try and be as helpful and specific as I can. And then in the next episode after this, we'll go back to discussing one particular topic around wildlife photography per episode. For now, Q&A, here we go. All right. First question comes from Daniela on email, who asks, wildlife often moves quickly. The temptation is to zoom right in and take the shot before the chance is missed. What is your best tip for thoughtfully composing wildlife shots? Okay, so composition, I think, is one of the things that people struggle with most in wildlife photography because it's not scripted in the way the technical things are. For example, shutter speed is 1 over 200, f is 2.8, and they each have a definite outcome. If your shutter speed is too slow, you will blur the shot and so on. Whereas composition is a much more of a creative thing, and there really is no right answer. However, the question that you asked Daniela here is the easiest way for me, and I do this with a lot of people on safari, is I'll say to them, you never ever start tight. So you don't arrive at a sighting and zoom right in and fill the frame with whatever you're looking at, because there's a very good chance you're gonna miss it. Like you say, these things move quick. So as a buffer or a kind of a safety net for you, I would always start by shooting wider, get the shot and then move in. If you have a lens like 100 to 400 or an 80 to 400 or a 70 to 300, anything there, I would always, if you're not sure what it is that you want, and quite honestly, very few photographers do, I would start on the wide end. So I would shoot 100, take a shot, zoom in, 200, take a shot, 300, shot, 400, shot, then pull back, go to portrait orientation and run through that again. I think I've spoken about this in the past, but what that will do is we'll give you 8 different shots. You will get some bank shots, which to me is the most important thing for a client. You need to bank your shots first, always. So that will make sure you don't chop stuff off. And by doing this exercise again and again, you're training your photographic eye, your photographic mind, your vision, if you will, of what the type of shots is that you want. So yes, the temptation with all wildlife photographers always is we need more glass, we need more reach. I think those shots can get boring after a while, even though, I mean, even I've still got it, is, God, there's a leopard, I must zoom in on the face. No, start wide and work your way in. Also, the moment there's any action, like for example, two species interacting or a chase that could happen or a bird that could take off, anything, is always pull back a bit. So frame your shot in camera, but pull back a bit, because if that leopard flicks its tail, if that roller opens its wings, if that lion shakes, and you take the shot and you were too tight, you're gonna chop something off. And once you chop it off, it's gone. So you would rather shoot a little bit wider and crop into the shot, not 50% in like 5 to 10%, but once you chop something off, it's gone. So best tip for thoughtfully composing is, I would, if you're not sure what it is that you want, I would work on your vision, and that's a whole different discussion. But start wide and go in with your zoom lens until you figure out where your happy spot is, where you find your cadence from a vision point of view, and this works for you, and that's where you stick. But I would rather you shoot a little bit wider than going in too tight. You cannot come back from that. Okay, next one. Rob asks on Snapchat, and sorry, Rob, it's taken me a couple of times to get this answer for you. Connectivity and social media while traveling. How do I manage getting connected and getting online and social media management while traveling? The easy answer here would be is get a local SIM card. Now, that presents certain challenges though. Some charge horrible prices. Others, for example, will only give you, and I had this the first time in the States a couple of years ago, where they offer, oh no, it's amazing, it's unlimited data, and here's a, you get 2 gigs free, and then it buffers you down to like, I don't know, 2 kilobytes of speed that you can use. So, Rob, what I normally do is, if I travel to a country often, and there's a lot of African countries, I mean, Kenya, we have an office there, the places like Botswana and so on, is I will try and get a local SIM card through some of my local contacts, load only data on there, because with things like WhatsApp, I don't have to have telephone, I can call through WhatsApp, and then go from there. The social media management, I've got another option for you coming up now, but the social media management side of it is I still, and this is something I'm seeing happening in the industry, is people starting to make the social media the reason they go into the field. That's all fucked up and wrong. Your reason, I'm talking from my point of view, what I'm doing, my reason for going into the field is to service my clients. The social media is a secondary part of it. So what I would normally do, whether I have signal in the field with my local SIM cards or not, is I might shoot some stuff either on my camera natively on my iPhone or even into Snapchat and Instagram while I'm on airplane mode, and then I will only go and DJ that out in the evenings when I get to my room. You don't want to be sitting there with your guests on your phone all the time and typing stuff and backspacing and stuff to get this stuff loaded. The focus is elsewhere. But it is very possible, Kenya, I'm thinking Kenya now because I'm going there in a couple of weeks for the Great Migration. There I have a SIM card. They have better connectivity next to the Mara River than I have in my office in Johannesburg. It's quite pathetic. But that, so it is possible. I just, from my point of view, I try and manage it from a guest expectation as well. Now, so the local SIM card and Wi-Fi, hopefully at the lodges, is the best way to go. And just as a side note here, see, there's my rabbit hole, is there is nothing better for me. Look, I like social media. I think I'm pretty good at it. And it's a language I understand. But I love, absolutely love going to places like Svalbard where I have no choice but to be disconnected. Those moments are valuable because you have no choice, but not only, and the choice I have on a normal trip is my choice is to service my clients, but on a place like Svalbard, I have no choice but to kind of take the time I would have spent on social for myself, and that's golden. So I like being disconnected once in a while, although I am all in on social. The one thing, Rob, that you can check out, and Sarah, if you are listening to this, I hope that SIM card is working for you. I recently discovered a thing called No Roaming. That's K-N-O-W, No Roaming. And what it is, they apparently used to have SIM cards, but you get this little sticker. So you take your SIM card out, you put this, it looks like a SIM card sticker. You put it on your SIM card, put it back in, and then there's an app, and you can literally switch between your home SIM, in my case, South African SIM, and this no roaming SIM. And what it does, they have obviously like contracts and stuff with service providers all around the world, and you can buy data packages. So if I land in a country, it'll say, hi, Jerry, you're in Norway. Do you want to buy a package? And here's your roaming rates. At drastically reduced roaming rates is fantastic. The nice thing for me on that is, so anywhere I travel in the world, I've never gotten to a place where they didn't have signal or coverage. So I'll, for example, land in a country, Uganda, and they'll say, hey, this is the local operator you and I are roaming on. These are your roaming rates for calls, messages, and for data. And you can also buy, for example, a $7 unlimited data package. So I did that when I was in Svalbard for Longyearbyen and in Norway, where I bought this unlimited package and it's golden. Here's the kicker though, for this no roaming SIM, and Rob, for travel, this is amazing, is you get unlimited free WhatsApp anywhere in the world. That is, if you guys are not on WhatsApp, it's incredible. So I can send messages, videos, images, and I can do voice and video calling out of WhatsApp completely free anywhere in the world on this SIM. It is absolutely amazing. If you guys want to send me an email, jerry@wildeye.co.za, I can send you the link. I think in South Africa, the iStores sell them, but you can get them online as well. No roaming SIM for me is now a given on any single trip. It's in my phone. When I travel, I just switch onto the no roaming SIM. I get back home, it switches automatically to my home SIM. It is very, very cool. And I think I've only had this now since the Svalbard and Gorilla trip, But Rob, it's definitely the way to go for me now forward. And then other than that is kind of managing the process every evening to get the social media stuff ticking over as well. Okay, next one from Corey. Corey wrote a bit of an email here. I'm going to read the whole thing for you so you know where he's coming from. Hey, Jerry, hope all is well. It is, thank you. I know you had a podcast about visualizing a location before going there. I'm heading to Scotland and I'm looked up places to take photos in Edinburgh. I found a website that listed 11 different spots where to try out. They look really cool locations to practice landscape and city photography for sure. So I wrote them down and will probably head to these places when I get there. Since I'm an amateur, my objectives are getting to know my camera and trying new things. Since I live in a city, I feel pretty good about what I'm going to shoot. On the opposite end, I commented on your picture in the Masai Mara. I would obviously love to get a picture like that and stars and crazy crossing pictures, etc. he says, I've made a whole picture list of inspiration for it, and that's a good thing to do. But I don't really know how to get them or what to expect when I'm there because the environment is so different from anything I've ever shot. Even when I was shooting in Kurongwe, it was savanna and not wide open. So it was actually similar to places around here without being very wooded. So that being a long-winded intro to my question, what do you usually do to prepare for a place and environment you haven't been before? This is a very good question, Corey, and something I think a lot of people, and look, it doesn't even go only for places that you haven't been. It goes for the same places you've been if you do your homework. Now, what I would do, any place I'm going, like for example, gorillas. When I did my first gorilla trip, I did a couple of things. Number one, like you did, I'll go and look at guides, like field guides, and read up on the area, how long it's been there, the topography, and so on and so forth. Then I'll go and Google images of the place. So I will put in Gorilla Volcanoes National Park, and in Google, I'll look at the images tab. Because I believe a lot in stimulating the photographic brain before you get into a place, knowing what is possible. You're going to see a lot of shitty images, make no mistake, but you are going to see images in that Google search that speaks to you. I will then also try and watch as many documentaries as possible on the place or the species that I'm going to photograph, because animal behavior and being able to predict that is the biggest variable in creating amazing images. You can know all the tech, but if you don't understand what the animal is doing, that's not going to be any good to you. So the documentaries gives me an idea of how an animal moves, and if it's an environment, what the light looks like at a certain time of day. I will then also, if I know of someone who works, for example, you go to the Mara, you're coming to the Mara with me next year, I think, yeah? So you could speak to me because I know the Mara backwards. You could say to me, how does this work? What should I take? And so on. I'll try and find someone who's considered a local area expert with good knowledge and chat to them and just check what lenses to take and so on and so forth. So once you have that text knowledge, the theory, the image knowledge, you have seen some videos and you've spoken to some people, you need to be very sure that you understand not only your camera, but your photography. You're going to get to a place where you don't know the subject, you don't know the area. However, the one thing that you can rely on is your own photographic knowledge and your knowledge of your camera. So let's say you're going to go photograph sloths. Is that a thing? Can we photograph sloths? You're going to photograph a sloth. You've looked at everything. You've seen videos. You see they move very slowly. When you're in the field, you're going to be torn between what that thing is doing and what you should be doing. So you can only control your own photography and your own camera. So you need to be very, very gelled and waxed on being able to look at a scene and think, ooh, that's going to move there. There's a slight background. I'm going to blur that out. Therefore, I need to. And then you dial in that variable into your camera. It's a little bit of everything. And I think the first time you go to a place, if you didn't do your homework, you might miss, you might swing and miss, but hey, that's it. That's school fees for the next time you go back. If it's a place that you reckon you're only going to go to once, like I had a client with me in Svalbard earlier this year, and more than likely, this is the only time he's ever going to go there. So I made a point in saying to him, we did all this homework. I sent him the links. These are my galleries from the last few years at the same time. Have a look. This is what's possible because it stimulates you photographically, and that's a great thing. But I said to him, overshoot. Because in most situations in Africa, for people who come on safari with me often, I don't frown upon it, but I kind of question when people just rattle away, when they just fire off 14 frames a second at every sighting and then choose afterwards. Because I think you're not doing yourself and your photographic mind any service by doing that. So if you're going to that place and you think it's going to be the only time, rather overshoot a little bit. But I'm not saying overshoot as in rattle off in one scene. Shoot a little bit, change of view. Shoot a little bit, change of view. If there's a sloth sleeping in a tree, shoot him with a 14 mil all the way to a 600, whatever lenses you have. But shoot more than you think, because afterwards you then have that option. You don't want to be sitting back after your trip to Karangwe or wherever you're going, saying, oh shit, this is so cool. If only I. If only in photography sucks, because you could have done something. So it's kind of a vague one, I think, but to me, it's a big deal. So I'm going up to Spirit Bears, the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia in a couple of weeks from now. And it's my first time. I've been doing homework like you cannot believe on the species, on the area, what to expect. I've looked at images where possible. I've looked at the settings people have used. I'm speaking to the operators, what kind of lenses. So I'm doing all that homework. I'm happy to back myself photographically that I know my photographic voice is quite switched on and I know how to translate that into my camera. I think maybe that's it, Corey, is can you translate what you see in your head and what you've seen online through your vision into your camera? Then you're going to win. There's still a couple of spaces left on that bear trip though too, if anybody's keen to come and join me. Should be amazing. Little pitch there. Anyway, Corey, so I hope that helps. We'll be shooting together in the migration end of next year. So, or August next year, I think. And we'll dig into more of this. But very good question. I think the one reason most people will fail on this is they're scared to do the work. People don't want to do the homework. And that's why they're going to get sub... Okay, maybe not. There's a very good chance they won't get as good images as they possibly can. But very, very good question. All right, moving on. Next question, this is four actually, comes from Matt. So I actually asked, when I started asking four questions on this particular podcast, the Wild Eye team, my guides all over the place, also pitched in with some questions, which is pretty cool. So Matt Armstrong stays in the UK. He's one of our guides on a freelance basis. We only have him as a freelance. All my guys are permanent. Matt's a very big part of our team, and he runs... private guided trips and specifically into Zambia where he guided for many years. Anyway, so Matt has a couple of questions here. First one, why travel with a private guide? Now, this is something, and I know why Matt's asking this because him and I have discussed this. So I'm going to answer this in terms of both client and guide. There's a big difference. So you need to understand if you're going to go to a lodge and they give you a guide, this is a question I get often though, is if I go to Mala Mala, I'm going to get a guide anyway. Why should you come with? Okay, because it is obviously a premium because we're very good at what we do. So you're paying for a premium service. Here's the thing. You get to a lodge, and I can say this because I was there. I was a guide at lodges many years ago. I know how it works. You work at a lodge for 6 weeks, then you have 2 weeks off. In your 6 weeks, you get given a roster. These are your people. They're coming with you. So every 3-4 days, depending on what the turnaround is, you pick up new guests, you drive them, and you go. At most lodges, 99% of lodges, your guide will be with you on the drives and that's it. Okay, their goal is not to make you a better photographer. Their goal is also not to kind of, it should be, unfortunately, but majority don't execute against this, should be to create a much bigger picture of Africa and not just of the local ecosystem you find yourself in. So the local guides, and there's some great guides out there, make no mistake, but their focus is interpreting the local area which they have the expertise on and then creating your experiences around that. Once you get back for breakfast, they go off because they've got other stuff to do and they've been working for 5 weeks and they're going to have a bit of a break. As a private guide, we not only take care of the moment you get in touch, your entire safari planning experience from start all the way to finish, we make sure that every single step of the way is done. So if you, for example, say I'm flying in from New York to Johannesburg and then I'm going to Mala Mala, I'll make sure that either, depending on when you arrive, you have one night in City Lodge before you fly out of Johannesburg or that your transfer is there half an hour before your plane gets in, stuff like that, which normal guides don't do. They just work at the lodge. So the private guide experience starts from when you book. At the lodge as well. So the private guide does not take over the job of the local guide. It's above and beyond. So the local guide's going to tell you about the Majigalon males or the Mapocho males or whatever these things are called of the area, what they've done, what they've fed on the last year, where their movements are. Because as a private guide coming in, working all over Africa, I might not know that details. However, on top of the knowledge and alongside the knowledge that the local guide gives you, there's a big, massive, huge value add of having a bigger context picture of, for example, this happens here, why doesn't it happen in the Mara, where we also work? or the lion prides in Zambia tend to be smaller than the ones in the Mara, which is very similar to the ones you get in the Mara. So there's much more context and depth to the experience from a knowledge point of view. Also, photographically, you cannot, as a guide driving a vehicle, you cannot pay attention 100% to your clients who are busy doing photography, because you're worrying about the driving, the guiding, the tracking, the radio, the spotlight, whatever. So as a private guide, that is why we are there, is to add knowledge and to add depth of experience and then to focus on the photography. More than that is when you get back to the lodge, during breakfast and then between drives, you have access to me, to Matt, to any of my private guides, to work on Lightroom, to work through field guides, to look at tracks, whatever it is that you want to get from the experience, you have access to that. And while your local guide goes and does his work, because he's paid to do those things at the lodge as well, you have access to your private guide. I think maybe it's the same as, for example, going to, I'm sucking this analogy, so let's see if it works, going to a gym and doing your own thing and kind of getting around and doing whatever you do, and you'll improve a little bit and the experience will be great. Or you get a qualified, professional, experienced personal trainer who will know what you want and they will make sure you get there. I think that works. So, Matt, that's why a private guide. I think, yes, it is a premium product, make no mistake. We don't give it away for free, but the experience is worth it. That's why a private guide. Okay, Matt, next question. Is it not dangerous going on safari in Africa? Now, it's an interesting question because what I realized my years are all mixed up, sorry, I don't know what day it is even. Last year in New York, we were at the New York Times Travel Show exhibiting Wild Eye as a photographic and private guiding specialist company. And the narrative that we use to a lot of our audience online has to do with bring this lens, that's the aperture, you need a raincoat for your lens going to the bush, you need to bring this, that. Most people, the majority of people, didn't think of that kind of thing. They were worried, is it safe to get from the airplane to the lodge? Yeah? They were worried, I mean, am I going to get murdered, raped, killed by a lion on my way from the airport to the lodge? Because unfortunately, Africa has this kind of stereotyped image that's out there, and it's all wrong. So I can answer your question, Matt, very simply. Is it not dangerous going on safari in Africa? No, it's not. I mean, I can ask you the same question in the reverse and say, is it not dangerous going to walk in the back streets of New York? Yeah, I'd probably shit myself. But if you, and especially if you work with a private guide, everything will be taken care of. If you work with an operator that knows what they're doing, you will not even go through the middle of Johannesburg City Center, which isn't that bad anyway. But it is a very, very safe thing. So that's from a crime and kind of lifestyle point of view. The whole, is it safe on the vehicle? That's a whole different discussion. But, and that comes down to guiding ethics and quality as well. All right, next one, also from Matt. Matt's got four questions. Are there any safari destinations that are still relatively unknown and not full of people? Matt, it's an interesting question that we spoke about in the office. Well, we actually speak about it quite regularly. And the challenge here is that something like the Masai Mara, which is a very popular destination, is getting very, very busy. And we do what we can to negate that busyness with our own camp because we have the ability. But a lot of places are getting overrun and tourism into Africa is growing. So are there places that are still relatively unknown? Yes. There's places like Chad is up and coming, middle of Africa. Gabon on the west coast is interesting. The problem there is that it offers a lot from a wildlife point of view, but the tourism infrastructure isn't there to sustain it. For example, there's Gabon I've been looking at recently. They've got incredible rainforests on the beach. You can get lions hunting buffalo, whatever, on the beach. It's ridiculous stuff happening there. But to get there and the prices they charge for a little wooden bed is something you would pay in South Africa for a 6-star lodge. So there are places, and if people are willing to rough it and go exploring, yes, as private guided trips, we are doing some trips into these areas. But I'm not comfortable yet to run photographic scheduled departures into these destinations because the infrastructure isn't there. And if I'm running a group of people, anything from 3 to 12, depending on what trip it is, I want to know that I've got infrastructure in the area, because it's not just about the experience, it's about the safety. There you go again. But I think there are a couple of upcoming places, Gabon, Chad, West Africa as a whole. There's some interesting stuff happening. But in your main areas, South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, there's some little reserves out of touch from places like Mana Pools where you might get a good experience as far as unknown. But sure, vast majority of the places, It's one of those things, hey? It's just growing and growing and growing. But yeah, there's places you can go and explore where I think you can find some good stuff. And then, fourth question from Matt is, who feeds the animals? So what happens every day on safari, roundabout Game Drive leaves at 3, right? So at about 4:30, most of the trainers come out, and then that's when the animals get fed. So the lion's normally closer to sunset, so when they start awake, I hope you guys know this is complete bullshit. Okay, no, seriously. It's one of those questions that I've had a couple of times on safari when I was at working at lodges. For example, can I drive by the lion cages? Or what time can we go and see the animals? Or what times do they get fed? So it is a question, and nobody feeds the animals, and I'm going to leave that there because we can get very silly with this one. Okay, cool. Matt, thanks. Very cool questions, man. Okay, I'm paging on here. Okay, next question from Shelley. Shelley says, your upcoming Great Bear Rainforest and Grizzly Safaris, how did these come about? How do any of your new safari destinations come about? Do you research and find exciting locations, or do they come to you, or do clients ask you to take them to specific locations with specific animals? Yes to all of the above, actually. So, I'm trying to think where the Spirit Bear came from. So, let me backtrack. Svalbard, I've never heard of, right? 5 years ago, 2012, I was sitting in Cape Town. I remember this like yesterday. At Cape Town, I was busy running a Great White Sharks safari workshop, like a photography workshop thing. And one of the clients, Jeremy, flew out from Norway to come and attend this thing, right? So we're sitting, and the one evening, we're busy Lightrooming our images from the day, and I'm doing a bit of a workshop thing. And he's going through his catalog, and suddenly there's this picture of this crystal clear water, just glass, flat, with a polar bear swimming almost like straight on, head on, nose just above the water. I was blown away. It's like, what the hell, dude? Where did you get that? So he told me about Svalbard. It took me a while to remember the name, Svalbard. But that was the Sunday evening of the workshop. Literally, Monday afternoon I got back. Tuesday morning in the office, I got all the details from Jeremy. I started following up. And the very next year, I ran a Svalbard trip. And I've been doing so ever since. So a lot of new destinations come from communication with people on safari. So people will show pictures, they'll tell us about places, they'll compare, for example, and the grizzlies is one of those. Because I've been doing polar bears for a long time, people started asking about grizzlies. And then one of my clients in the Mara a couple of years ago mentioned British Columbia, which I've always known is apparently just beautiful. But a couple of people start mentioning it, wanted to say we should go there, we do homework, we speak to people, say, listen, we're doing this trip, are you keen to come because you said you are? And then it kind of takes a life from there. That's the photo departure. So a scheduled departure is one that we pre-book the places at the lodges, and then we sell it to people to come and join us on this trip. It's, for example, from the 2nd of March to the 10th of March, they're preset dates. Those trips we're trying now, once we've kind of cemented our role in Africa. So we've got a good footprint of the lodges that we use and the areas we use in Africa. And a lot of people who have been traveling us for 4, 5, 6, 10 safaris now want to do something else. And I'm very grateful for this, they want to go and photograph places like the grizzlies and the Great Bear Rainforest with us because of the photographic knowledge and experience we bring to the party. So that's quite great. On a private guided basis, we go anywhere. So you could say to me, Shelley, you could say, listen, I want to go and photograph, for example, elephants in Chad, and I can put a private guided trip together for you. You will have the understanding that that I've never been there, but linking to one of the previous questions, I feel very confident that I can take you to any wildlife destination in the world, and I know I'll be able to add value because of the photographic knowledge, because of the photographic creativity, and the understanding of how to teach you to photograph. So, answer your question, it's a little bit of everything. We also see some places that we're keen on, and when people then ask, they want different places, we say, oh, hey, did you hear about the grizzlies or whatever? So it's a little bit of everything, and it's an evolving thing. So over the next year, new trips for me, so grizzlies and spirit bears later this year in Canada is a new one for me. Next year, Borneo is new. As a company, my company is also launching India, which is new for us. And the nice thing is the trips are filling up. My grizzly bear trip's fully booked. India for us, I think there's one spot left. Pantanal is fully booked. So it shows that there's something that we do, and again, I'm super grateful for this, that people enjoy, and that's why we also want to expand and give our clients that wider offering, which is nice. Shelley's got a second question here, which says, when are you coming to Michigan to host a safari? Okay, Shelley, if you can Snapchat me, because I know we chat on Snapchat, if you can send me a species list of what I could expect to photograph there, we can discuss. Okay, moving on. Who's this from? Okay, Johan, also one of my guys at Wild Eye, asks, with most people only seeing the romance of our job, what is the part you dislike most of what you do? Interesting question. I think leaving home. It's simple as that. It's at the... Okay, let me draw an analogy for you. When I was at the lodges, you get to a point running lodges because it's cookie cutter. I mean, it's Groundhog Day again and again and again, the same thing. And there you start not enjoying the routine. Because for me, it was just too much. I'm too busy. My mind is too active to do the same thing day after day after day. So lodge life absolutely killed me after a while. But right now, having the privilege of going around the world and showing and helping people to create better images, the toughest thing that I dislike is not being home. And maybe it's an age thing. Maybe it's because I'm getting a bit older. I've had a lot of travels in my life and I absolutely love what I do. But the best destination for me always is coming home. So I've got a shitload of travel coming up in August and September. And it's already kind of a, it's not a big thing, but there's this bubbling underneath knowing that for the next 3 weeks, I've got to spend as much time with family and friends as possible. I want to spend as much time at home as possible with my boys. I want to train as hard as possible because I've got 3 weeks and then you're going away. It's that kind of mindset to me, which, and I'm very lucky that I have so much at home that I'm wanting to stay for, yet I get to do what I do. So Johan, it's a great question and I'm caught between kind of loving what I do and wanting to stay home. So that would be it, hey? I mean, other than that, people could say, you know, I dislike it when the shit hits the fan on a trip and the plane doesn't arrive. You know what? It is what it is. It's, we're professionals at what we do. It's something I have to deal with, manage the guests' expectations and experience while shitting on the operators because my plane didn't arrive. It's what we do. So I don't dislike that. Actually, the challenge every once in a while is quite nice. But yeah, I think for me is home time. That's really it. Next question from Johan again. What part of photography do you feel people struggle with most? Easy, creativity. However, I think it's not a difficult thing to work on, creativity and photography and kind of seeing and fostering and building a vision. I think people hide behind the technical side of it because it's easy. Technical is easy. Don't give me that shit of, no, it's not easy, it's all these numbers. No, it is easy if you focus on it. People don't want to dig into the creative side because there's no rules. People like to know that, what should my shutter speed be? What should my ISO be? What should my aperture be? These are the questions we get on Safari often. They don't ask, how can I best capture the feeling of this scene? That's a great question because that'll also take technical into account. So I think people hide behind the technical side of it saying they don't understand it or they want to focus on that because they're scared of creativity. Doesn't have to be. So for me, I think the main thing that people struggle with is creativity, is how to narrate, how to story tell without images looking flat and boring. Last one from Johan here I've got is, what advice would you give to a guide just starting his career now? One word, network. You need to network off the bat. If you're starting in the industry now, you have so much going for you. You've got Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, YouTube, whatever, podcasts. I mean, shit, if I could start my industry now with my knowledge, if I could start in the industry now with what I know, I'd be doing a daily podcast every day after Game Drive, literally, every day. I would post an image a day to my Instagram. And even if I'm not going to sell anything to anybody yet or run safaris and I'm working at a lodge, I would network with guests. I would keep a proper database of guest contact details. I would network online and build a brand around myself so that one day, and I'm assuming, Johan, you're asking about a guide starting a lodge, one day I'll be ready to go out and crush it because you'll have people following your podcast, following your YouTube, your Snapchat. You'll have a database of people who have traveled with you and more than likely will again. But the guides don't get it. If I look at some of the guides at the lodges where we travel to, it's amazing. They think it's a ride. They do their 6 weeks, they go on holiday, they blow their lot, and they don't add any value to the online community, which is where the world is going. So, Johan, I would go with any guide. If any of you guys are listening, new guides, network and build an online platform for yourself. You have the difficult thing with social is people don't know what content to put out there. You guys and us, me, doing what we do out in the field every day, we've got content pouring out of our ears with images. You could do a 10-minute podcast. Fuck it. You could do a 5-minute podcast over every Game Drive when you get back and upload that. People will eat it up, guaranteed. So, for new guides, network, network, networks. Only thing you should be doing. All right, ooh, Grant as well. A lot of the guides now here to end us off with. Grant says, Grant also runs some of migration trips. He's a full-time guide in Madikwe, but great friend, great guide. I've been getting a question lately from a lot of guests or at Nkuru, the lodge he's managing. Why are my images looking flat and I'm shooting on zero exposure? How does exposure work? So, Grant, this is a question. I know you've been answering this for your clients, but I'm glad you asked this. Over the last year, 2016, yes, a lot of time on our wild eye safaris was spent on exposure. People don't understand how exposure works. They don't even understand that they can over and underexpose on their camera, and it'll look washed out or look too dark and so on and so forth. I'm not sure where to take this because I can waffle on for about half an hour on this, but the biggest thing that you need to understand is if people can understand what a histogram is and how it works, then you'll understand exposure and how to compensate in camera and not get those flat images. So if you look at a histogram, that's a little mountain squiggly thing that you can see on the back of your screen if you cycle through the play modes. Left on that thing is pitch black, white is on the far right. So left is black, right is white. If that histogram is touching on the left, it means there's black. If it touches on the right, it means there's pure white. If it doesn't touch either side, there's no pure white and pure black in this image. Guys, I've done podcasts, I've done blog posts on this. Email me, I'll send you the link. You can, by over and underexposing in camera, you can tell the camera to go darker or lighter. This is a fundamental of technical photography. You need to understand this. So people, and maybe it comes back to that previous creative question where people look at an image and say, oh, it's flat. You're so worried about, is it flat or not? If you have shitty content, it doesn't matter if it's flat or not, delete the image. The best thing you can do when you look at exposure is email me, I'll send you the link to the exposure blog post we've done, but learn what the histogram is and learn how to over and underexpose. It is powerful, and depending on which mode you are, it will even give you that little bit of extra shutter speed. I'm talking from an aperture mode here, which is, it's vital. So that for me, Grant, I'm actually going to put this one on the shelf and deal with this in a separate blog post, maybe even a video, because there's a lot of detail there. You need to protect your blacks, protect your whites. It's not a racial thing. Stop. Protect your blacks, protect your whites, and make sure that you get as much detail in the histogram as possible in order to process later on. Okay, I'm on the last page here that I've printed out. I think some are still at the office, but we'll bump those to next time. Is Mike. Michael from the office. You guys follow him on Snapchat, I hope. Pretty cool guy. One of my full-time guides at Wild Eye. Question one, is what we do really a holiday job? Okay, so I know this is asked in jest, but it's something that I get a lot. People ask, oh, yeah, are you going on holiday again when I'm going on a trip? My first reaction is to punch them in the face because no respect for what we do, but I get where it comes from. I really, really do. And no, it's not a holiday job. I mean, you need to do this full-time, all in or not. The one thing that pisses me off, though, is people, and I had a bit of a rant post on my Instagram a little while ago in this last week where there's people in the industry who do what I do, and they'll say, oh, yeah, my job doesn't feel like a job. It's like I'm sharing my passion and I'm living my dream. You know what? Keep that shit in your pocket. I want this to feel like a job. I want to know that I'm accountable to my team in the office and to my guests for the money they're paying for their experience to make sure expectations are met and exceeded, that everything works, that they get a great experience. So I get where the question's coming from, and I get why a lot of people would say, oh, you're going on holiday again. But I personally make a conscious effort to keep the grind going, the hustle going, to make sure this is a job and that I do that job very, very well. Go and check out, I think it's like Wednesday last week, on my Instagram. The images are one whole bunch of little pictures of me, and then read that post because that's really, really how I feel about it. Next question from Mike here. If you could start your adult life / career over, would you have taken a different path or changed a few things? Now, I don't know if I've ever done this, but I'm going to do the short version here, and I'll tell you, I will not change a single thing because every single thing I've ever planned hasn't worked out like I wanted to anyway, and it's been amazing. So I went to school, I went to university, I studied sports psychology. I was in my honours year when I started doing gymnastics. I was going to do my M, my master's in sports psychology, yet I won nationals that year. Went to dad, this gymnastics, went to dad, said, what do I do? Do I do psychology studies or sport? He said, you choose. I chose sport. So first of all, I was going to do psychology, and then it changed. I did sport for a long time. When I retired from competitive gymnastics, I had the choice of coaching the national team back in South Africa, or I could go and work on a ship. An opportunity presented itself. I chose the ship. There's another choice. I probably would have gone the gymnastic route, but things just worked out. The ship ended. I had a choice coming back to South Africa or working in North Island. I went the North Island route in Seychelles. Managed guest relations for one of Wilderness Safari's properties there. Came back to South Africa. Had the option of going back into health and wellness or to start managing lodges. I started managing lodges. So the route for me, Mike's never been a kind of a clear-cut one. I didn't go, it's not the whole thing of go to university, find your husband and wife there, qualify in something, buy a house with white picket fences, station wagon, Labrador, 2.5 kids, 60 years later get a gold watch and retire. I didn't do that. So I wouldn't take a single different path. I think the important thing for me is I'm open to whatever comes along. And if an opportunity presents itself, I will always look at it, even though I might not think I'll actually follow through. So, no, Mike, short version, no, wouldn't change a thing. Next one. Do you have any worries or concerns before your travels? Sure. Interesting one. I think not really at this stage. Initially, maybe yes, with Wild Eye, because there was Andrew and myself basically did everything. And now with having a full team, I mean, I can midnight, any time of day, anywhere in the world, I can phone my office and ask them to deal with something and it'll work. So having that backdrop for me is great. I think the stuff I worry about before a trip is more personal. I mean, I'm not worrying about the logistics of the safari. That's going to happen regardless. But it's, what new value can I bring to guests, especially if they've been with me before? So that's why for me, it's a continuous thing of reading and keep myself fresh so I can add more value. I'm worried about things like at home. I mean, is Adele and the boys, are they going to be cool? I mean, is my mom and dad going to be fine? I worry about not being able to train because I need it. So there's those kind of personal worries, Mike. But from a trip point of view and a logistical point of view, no. Because I think we've done the hard graft for the infrastructure to be in place. So I don't have to worry about that. But yeah, mostly personal things maybe. But also I think maybe I'm too hard on myself. But what new value can I bring to people on a trip that have traveled with me? That's kind of what I worry about. And what Mike got you? As the last question, what is your favorite thing about what you do? I'll tell you the one story. I can't remember. I've told this in videos. But the moment that I realized I enjoy what I do, and it's kind of filtered all the way from there. I had a private guided trip with two ladies in Madikwe. This must be about 6 or 7 years ago. And it was just before Wild Eye. I was still running Photo Africa, which is my previous company, which was the same thing as this, just obviously me, small scale. And we went to Madikwe and Photo Safari, private guided thing, just me and the two of them and then our local guide, going around this, that. And one of the things that they wanted to work on was star photography. So we, one morning early, I think it was like 2:30 or 3, we left the lodge to go to Klo Dam in Madikwe, which is great for star photography. So we drive through the cold, half an hour drive to the dam. It's cold as hell. We get there. As we get out, the lady says to me, oh shit, I forgot my tripod. Now, obviously we're gonna do stars. So I said to her, okay, no worries, here, you can have mine. So at this stage, I was a lot younger and I was kind of getting into the whole thing. Deep inside, I was more than happy for her to take my tripod, which means I couldn't shoot. But deep inside, I thought, fuck man, I knew, and it was great. The stars were amazing. And anyway, so I'm like, okay, anyway, move on. So we go and we're shooting stars. Try this, do this, blah, 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 blah. So we change composition. The stars change. There's a bit of clouds coming in. These images coming in is amazing. And she says to me, okay, she wants to try something new. So she sets it up with a dead tree. The elephants pushed that tree over subsequently, by the way. But it was still there. And she sets up the shot. And I kind of peek over her shoulder as she's going. She dials all the settings in. And she hits click. So a 20-second exposure. We're standing there kind of listening to the night sounds and stuff. It's great. And the shutter closes. And as the image pops onto the back of her camera, she looks down at it. She turns to me and says, look what I just did. And in that moment for me was worth everything. And that moment for me, when I knew that I helped someone, not just by giving her my tripod, but by guiding and teaching her how to do and how to create that image, and that she turned to me and said, look what I just did. To me, the value and why I enjoy what I do was caught up in those couple of words, is look at what I just did. And I felt proud, and I mean, almost a little bit emotional. It was dark, so she couldn't see, but okay, it's a joke. But I was super proud and quite emotional of that moment that I've created for someone. Until today, that is still the reason. Is some people are struggling in the car and they get upset because their images are all crap and stuff. We all do it. But then later that evening at the lodge or at the camp, working through the stuff and then having someone, and I might not even be talking to them. I'll just sitting working at them across the table. And you can see that penny drop of, wow, I just did this. And I think, Mike, that to me is why I do what I do. It's those moments that empower people creatively, technically, inspirationally, whatever, to enjoy and become better at their craft. And this is not a bullshit story. It really, really is that moment of, look what I just did. That, if I can create that for someone, that's the best part of my job. Anyway, guys, it is Monday morning now. It's 7:45. I've got to hit the road to the office. There's some more questions and stuff back at the office, which I didn't print. I didn't plan to do this from home. So I'm going to bump them onto the next one. If you have other questions you would like, anything, anything from me personally to photographic safaris to travel Africa, whatever it is that I can try and answer for you, let me know. And maybe episode 60, we'll do this again. So every 10 episodes, we'll do a bit of a Q&A and answer questions with regards to anything that has to do with wildlife photography. I think that's it. So from tomorrow, from the next episode, back with normal single topic discussions on wildlife photography. The first one I think I still need to do, and this is the next one, is should you always travel with the same photographic guide? I have mixed feelings. I'll share them with you tomorrow in the next episode. As always, guys, thank you so much for listening. Thanks to all of you that send your questions in and keep them coming. I'll add them up and then episode 60, we do it again. More Q&A, good fun, and I think there's a lot of interesting value and some good laughs in there as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. I will chat to you all in the next episode. My name is Jerry. I'm from Wild Eye. Have a good one.